to kick this thing off. Can I kick it off? One, two, three, boom.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of World History Class with Mr. Lutz. Today's episode is going to be focused on the classical civilizations of India. So we'll be talking about the Maurya and the Gupta Empire, but we'll also be placing some of our focus on the development of Hinduism and Buddhism in India. And one of the big things that I want to pull out in today's episode is trying to draw some comparisons between India during this time period, that is period two, and China, which is the chapter that you would have just read about. And I want to do this because it's really important that you understand these chapters aren't meant to be understood in isolation of one another. I think I said this in the last episode. Each time you're reading a chapter, you should be thinking about what you've already read in terms of comparison for similarities or differences, to think of patterns of change and continuity over time. Because honestly, these are the types of themes we'll be emphasizing all year long in class. And the more you do it on your own as an individual, the more naturally ingrained these habits become, and the simpler the tasks will be for you in class. So prior to us diving into the key concept connections, very, very briefly, I just want to give you a bit of a geographical overview of India to compare with China so you can kind of see some of the differences. And this is mentioned in your textbook as well. But basically, you're looking at what's called the Indian subcontinent. And the Indian subcontinent is Asia that is separated by the Himalaya Mountains. So that is going to be a geographic barrier, but there are mountain passes that will allow outside groups, be it traders or merchants or invaders, to come through and intermingle with the people of South Asia. And China has its own set of geographic barriers, whether it's the Tibetan Plateau in the western part of the country, the southwestern part that is, or it's going to be the deserts of the northwestern parts of the country. These are also considered geographic barriers, but I think another thing that we need to understand is just the geographic distance that exists between China and other civilizations versus India and other civilizations at this point in time really matter, because India's proximity to places like Rome and the Persian Empire, it's going to help make closer links between them and these civilizations, whereas China is further removed, being further to the east. So you're going to see some differences in the way that Chinese civilization is going to develop and emerge, as well as Indian civilization. And it's also going to affect the way they see the rest of the world. And that's all I want to say for now. I don't want to emphasize it too much, but I want you to understand those themes, and then you'll see how that impacts the historical developments. Okay, so for this week's key concept connections, like I said last episode with China, we're going back over these key concepts again and again. I'm not going to give you the whole rundown of each key concept like I did with last episode. I want to start with key concept 2.1, which is as states and empires increased in size and contacts between regions intensified, human communities transformed their religious and ideological beliefs and practices. So we're talking religion here, which falls later on in the chapter that you're reading than it does in the podcast that I'm narrating to you guys right now. But I think it's important to set up with religion first, and then as we talk about the Maurya and Guptas, it will make a little bit more sense how they are a product of their religious influences. So when we talk about the history of religion in South Asia, my starting point for you is going to be with the Aryan invaders, the Aryan migrants who are Indo-Europeans. We mentioned that a few episodes back, the hunting and gathering peoples who are living in Central Eurasia and who are migrating all throughout, whether it's into South Asia, whether it's into the Middle East, or whether it's even into Northern Europe. These Aryans are going to come down and they are going to bring with them certain belief systems and values that will shape what will become Hinduism. And I want to start with the texts known as the Vedas. The Vedas, what they are concerned with typically are going to be the rituals and the prayers and the songs and the traditions that will be carried out by the priestly class known as the Brahmins. And so with mentioning this priestly class, it's important to then emphasize what comes from the Aryans. Most importantly, in my opinion, is going to be the Varnas, which when the Portuguese later interact with the Indians, they will call the caste system. So the Rig Veda is where the caste system will emerge from. And in the caste system, the four major Varnas, at the top, you have the priestly class, who are known as the Brahmins. Underneath the Brahmins, you have the warrior class, known as the Kshatriya. They are followed by the traders and farmers, known as the Vaisyas. And then at the bottom, you have the Sudras, who are your laboring class. There is a fifth group that kind of falls outside of the system, per se. They are known as the Dalits, or the Untouchables, or if we're talking in the days of Gandhi, the Harijan, or the Children of God. So there's another Hindu text that's known as the Upanishads, and that's the one that I really want to focus on, because the Upanishads is where some of the most important concepts that define Hinduism come about. First of all being, I'm going to really enunciate this one for you because I think it's important to note the differences here, Brahman, as opposed to Brahmin. We'll get back to that later on the episode. Brahman being the universal soul, and Atman being the individual soul. And this idea that one's Atman is in unison with the Brahman. I know that's not the right pronunciation, but I'm trying to over-enunciate here because it can get confusing. And I'm sure you're like, yeah, definitely feeling that right now. And this idea that one's life is trapped in a cycle of birth and rebirth. And that is known as samsara. And after your life embodied in this one soul expires, it immediately is reincarnated into a different form. And that form could be higher or lower status, depending on the karma one has accumulated in their life. And that is dictated on whether or not one follows and carries out their duties in their life, or their dharma. So I've thrown a lot of different vocabulary terms at you there, but those things are the essential concepts in Hinduism. This idea that life is governed by cycle of birth and rebirth, and there is duties that one must carry out according to their caste in life. And if they do so, they can be reborn as a higher being, or if they reach that eternal state of divinity, they are able to achieve what is known as moksha, which is when they unite with Brahman, that universal soul, and they break the cycle of reincarnation or samsara, because that is ultimately the goal, to become one with the universal soul. And so again, all of those beliefs are going to come from the Upanishads. And a really important thing to note before I move out of the beliefs of Hinduism, we really need to understand Hinduism's foundations cannot be attributed to a single founder, as in Jesus Christ for Christianity. And it cannot be chalked up to follow the teachings of this one person. For instance, the Pope with Catholicism today, there is no single leader of the faith. There is no single founder of the faith. And you have these laws, these social laws per se, that are governed through caste. And so what that means then is there is an absence of religious leadership. And there is a lack of a need per se for political laws, because you have religious governance stepping in to manage these affairs and these social interactions. And that's going to have an impact on the ability of leaders to govern in Indian society. So compare with China, when we talk about Confucianism, where there is this embedded relationship-based structure all the way down from the family unit that goes all the way up to the emperor who rules with the mandate of heaven, saying that they've been blessed by the gods to rule over the people, and so long as they provide good governance and a good way of life for their people, they continue to possess that mandate of heaven. So you see right there, religion is playing a part in statecraft and helping to provide stability for those who govern. But in the case of India, the religion has created an atmosphere where there is not one single ruler. And so the people of the upper caste in India can compete with each other regionally or just decide to coexist and not allow for one group of people to take charge and take control of the rest of them. So whereas China's history is going to be one of political centralization, India's history, for the most part, is going to be a history of political decentralization. And now you may be wondering, why does this religion spread? What is the appeal of it? It sounds so restrictive, especially for people of lower castes. But I think what you need to understand is, while on one hand it does serve to solidify the social structures of India, it also does help answer a lot of questions that people have about their life. It helps give them a purpose and meaning of why are we here right now? Where do we go once this life expires? What am I to do in the meanwhile? If you stop and think about it, Hinduism does answer a lot of those questions. And this doesn't even mention the fact that Hinduism is very able to adjust and adapt to new religious influences. It can take popular beliefs of other religions and find a way to incorporate those values and beliefs into their own religious traditions. And so into this world of Hinduism, in 563 BCE is born Siddhartha Gautama, who is the son of a noble living near the Himalayas in what would be considered probably modern day Nepal. And this man, Siddhartha Gautama, is destined to become a great ruler. But the thing that has to happen is his father has to provide a very positive and happy life for him and ensure that his son never leaves home. But Siddhartha Gautama always wanted to go out and see the world. And so at the age of 29, he is going to leave his home four separate times. And in these four separate times, he is going to come across four different people. The first time he comes out, he sees an old man. The second time, a sick man. The third time, a corpse. And the fourth time, he sees a peaceful, wandering, holy man. And what Gautama is going to realize is that in those first three interactions, life is characterized not by this world of tranquility and peace and beauty all the time, but life is characterized by a lot of suffering and a lot of hard times and a lot of pain. But then in that fourth interaction, he comes across this wandering holy man and he realizes this man is at peace. This man has found satisfaction. And so he realizes that to escape this suffering, he needs to devote his life to one of religious devotion. So he's going to try to find a way to end his suffering. And he's going to try a lot of different ways to do this, whether it's debating and discussing and trying to hammer out these issues through thought and constructive discussion. He's going to try to deprive himself and feed himself on 6 grains of rice per day. And he's realizing these things don't work. And so then he's just going to sit underneath a banyan tree. And he's going to meditate underneath that tree for over a month straight. And in that meditation, he's going to discover an end to this suffering. And at that moment, Siddhartha Gautama is going to transform from Gautama into who we know as the Buddha. So that's kind of the brief historical background of how Buddhism is going to develop. And what the Buddha is going to start to do is he's going to start to share his teachings and his findings with the people he interacts with. And the first teaching that he's going to share with the people is what is known as the Four Noble Truths, which I think is the most brief and concise way to summarize what exactly do Buddhists believe. So the first noble truth is probably the one you're most familiar with based on what I've just told you, and that is that life is full of suffering. The second noble truth is that the cause of this suffering stems from human desire for temporary pleasures that exist in our world. The third noble truth that comes about from the teachings of the Buddha is that the way to end suffering is to try to find a way to quash human desire. And the fourth noble truth that emerges is that in order to overcome these desires and to attain the status of a Buddha or an enlightened one is to follow the Eightfold Path. And simply put, the Eightfold Path would advise one to live a life of moderation. And it's important to understand about Buddhism that it rejects the idea of the necessity for a caste system. It emphasizes to live, like I said, this life of moderation and not one of excessive lavishness. So think about it. This is really going to appeal to those lower caste members that live in India. And that's who originally is going to find value in the teachings of the Buddha. So there's your overview of at least Hinduism and Buddhism in India. And of course, we'll build on those things in class. But I wanted to move on to the state apparatus in India at this time. So this takes us to key concept 2.2, which the brief overview goes as follows. As the early states and empires grew in number, size, and population, they frequently competed for resources and came into conflict with one another. India prior to the rise of the Mauryan dynasty is going to be characterized by these smaller different states that exist. And some of these are ruled by a monarch. Some of these are a republic, but they are dominated typically by the upper classes, the Brahmin class, who are the priests, or the Kshatriya, who are your warrior classes. But in 322 BCE, Chandragupta Maurya is going to successfully unify much of India. And in order to do this, he is going to have a massive army that is going to help enforce his rule. He's going to start to develop his bureaucracy and improve upon that. And he's really going to have a couple of schemes and strategies and ways about himself to make this happen. And it's going to be in thanks to Chandragupta Maurya's advisor. More on that difference in a little bit here. Kautilya. And Kautilya is going to develop policies that are going to include the use of spying on enemies and political assassination. Dun, dun, dun. In order to maintain a grip on imperial control, because India is a difficult beast to tame politically. So you've got to be willing to get your hands a little bit dirty and engage in some of the dark arts to hold power in India. And Chandragupta Maurya is going to be willing to do this because he wants to be the one who governs India. But also, from a more practical standpoint, Chandragupta Maurya is going to develop bureaucracy. He's going to split the empire into four provinces, and each of these four provinces are going to be governed by princes who are going to help manage the legal affairs and taxation. So even though Chandragupta Maurya has a centralized state, he's still relying on local princes to manage those legal affairs and the taxation issues on the local level here. So we're never really going to get the same centralized, highly, highly developed bureaucracy that we would see in China. And Chandragupta Maurya's grandson, Ashoka, is going to continue this pattern of expansion and consolidation of the Mauryan Empire, and he's willing to get his hands just as dirty, if not dirtier, earlier on than his grandfather. He is going to have a war with the people of Kalinga, and in this war, he is going to have slaughtered over 100,000 people. Not personally, that would be, I don't know if the word's impressive or awful, it's probably both, let's be honest. Anyway, after this happens, this wide-scale destruction on the people of Kalinga, Ashoka has a realization that he can't go on living like this. And he has a really hard time swallowing the guilt that he has for what he has done. And so what he decides to do is he becomes Buddhist. He converts to Buddhism. And he's going to adopt a life dedicated to nonviolence for the rest of time, for the rest of his time, that is. Now, some people do think that his conversion to Buddhism was born out of the destruction that he brought onto the people of Kalinga. Others believe that he tried to use Buddhism as a tool with which to culturally unify India. And they might point to what are known as Ashoka's pillar edicts, which are basically pillar edicts. They are pillars of stone. Written on those pillars of stone are edicts in which he will make imperial decrees, but he will also encourage his subjects to convert to Buddhism, and he will also try to stress his desire to be a just and humane ruler. But the Mauryan Empire will not last forever, and after the life of Ashoka, it will start to crumble, and that's born as a result of overstretched finances. You've spent so much money on this powerful military to enforce your rule, and a large bureaucracy to maintain daily affairs as well as to generate tax revenue. And it just overstretches the finances of the empire, which they can't sustain. So the Mauryas will decline, and there will be a long period of decentralization. The Kushan Empire will emerge, and we'll get to them when we get to trading throughout Eurasia. But I wanted to turn our focus to the Gupta Empire before we conclude with state affairs. So, buckle up. The first ruler of the Gupta Empire is Chandra Gupta, not Chandra Gupta Maurya, and they're not related. I know, you might have to rewind that back and listen a few times to make sure you process that, but you'll get there soon, I promise. So the Guptas are going to base their control off of some conquering of regional kingdoms, but also having tributary alliances with those they decide not to fight. And they really keep decision-making throughout the empire decentralized as well, leaving things to be done on the local level, which... So this does allow for science and mathematics to flourish in India, and you're going to get the value of pi from these people. Yep, you can thank them for that. As well as the concept of a numerical value for zero. But politically, it's not going to be that enduring of an empire. And so when the White Huns, who are a nomadic invader from Central Asia, come into the subcontinent in the 5th century CE, you're going to see the collapse of the Gupta dynasty. So let's briefly touch on key concept 2.3, which I had not read to you in the last episode, so I'll do that quickly here. With the organization of large-scale empires, the volume of long-distance trade increased dramatically. Much of this trade resulted from the demand for raw materials and luxury goods. Land and water routes linked many regions of the Eastern Hemisphere. The exchange of people, technology, religious and cultural beliefs, food crops, domesticated animals, and disease pathogens developed alongside the trading goods across extensive networks of communication and exchange. In the Americas and Oceania, localized networks developed. So very briefly, just to mention, with the Indians being in closer proximity to some larger states at this time, there's going to be an emphasis on trade that is larger in China. And that's also due to the fact that Confucianism does de-emphasize the societal value in trade. So you're going to have overland trade, of course, that's going to be linked along the Silk Road, but you're also going to have overseas trade. And this is going to be due to the fact that Indian sailors will use what are called the monsoon winds, and they travel in patterns. Those winds go in patterns depending on the season. These sailors will learn those patterns and will travel according to them. So you will get traders from southern India. These are the Tamil people, and they're going to trade goods like cotton and silks and different things, pepper, manufactured goods as well, all throughout Southeast Asia and even into the Middle East. And pepper is going to be something that becomes popular in Rome, and that's going to kind of take us into our zooming in as well. So today's zooming in, we're going to talk food, folks. We're going to talk about a dish that I think is possible for you to cook even if your only skills in cooking is being able to microwave bagel bites. And this dish is known as cacio e pepe. There are four ingredients: spaghetti, pecorino romano cheese, black pepper, and salt. That's it. So why I bring this up is because this dish has everything to do with history and especially with trade. Cacio e pepe is a dish that comes from ancient Rome, and it was thought to be, and I'll link the article I got this from in the episode description, it was thought to be developed first by Roman sheep herders who would bring some dried pasta out along with them while they were letting their sheep graze on open land. And from the milk that would come from these sheep, you would get pecorino cheese. And the only other ingredient that we need is black pepper. Now, the pasta is coming from the wheat that's grown throughout the Roman Empire. The cheese is coming from the aforementioned sheep. But where's the black pepper coming from? The answer, India. So there it is. Trade bringing about these dishes that are a part of our culture, and we don't even think about the history behind them. And I think this is one of the coolest things about world history, is that you can look at a dish that you eat, and you can stop and think about the way world history has shaped that dish. And it's typically only talked about with, I don't know, like the Columbian Exchange, the idea that tomatoes come from the Americas, but the tomatoes on your pizza are from an Italian restaurant. So yes, tomatoes did not originate in Italy. And it's those kinds of things that will always keep world history at the forefront of your brain as you're eating that favorite plate of pasta that you're making. I'll link the recipe as well. I think you can make it. I believe in you. Today's explainer, I want to keep really brief, and I just want to go over the point of what's called analysis. That is explaining the why a historical process developed as it did. And for that, I think you should turn to page 63 in your textbook, and it's the very last paragraph or two that you'll see there, and it talks about the impact of the caste system. So the question could be, why is India going to be politically decentralized? And the why explanation here, the analysis, tells us that there's so much that is governed in terms of human behavior and social behavior through the caste system. It makes the idea of political regulation sort of redundant and not all that needed. So when you ask, why is India politically decentralized? It's because, in part, of course, the caste system provides so much organization, there's not a need for a centralized state to help support with additional organization. Now, today's recommendation, it's not going to be something that you should go check out. It's something I recommend you doing as you read through your Stern's textbook. And that is to acknowledge the fact that Stearns likes spelling things differently from the way a lot of other people like to spell things. Case in point for this chapter is going to be the Brahmins class, or the Brahmins caste. He is going to spell it B-R-A-H-M-A-N, which is problematic because everyone else spells it B-R-A-H-M-I-N. Because the one that's spelled with an A, you are going to associate with that universal soul. And I'd rather you associate that one. So my point to you folks is, if you come across something in the textbook that's spelled one way, and then you come across that seemingly same term spelled a different way in one or two other sources, in all honesty, I would go with the spelling the other thing has used, as opposed to the one that Stearns is using. So again, Brahman with an A, the universal soul. Brahmins with an I is going to be the priestly caste, and Brahma with an A, no N on the end, is going to be one of the gods of Hinduism. So just make sure you stay up to par with those differentiating things and always ask for clarification if you in fact need it. So that's it for today. Take care, everyone.